what I'm talking about is a knowing system where people were discriminated against and denied things they were entitled to, that they paid taxes for. And after they were denied those things, and also they were levied fraudulently high tax assessments by federal tax assessors. So what happens after that is they end up losing the land.
The story of how a million black farmers were cheated out of their land in the Mississippi Delta. We'll have that later in the show. First, we've been talking a lot about the conditions in jails and prisons in this country in the wake of Jeffrey Epstein's death. Seems the federal lockup he was in was overcrowded and understaffed. That's something that plagues the L.A. County Jail, too. In fact, that jail is one of the most notorious in the nation for squalid conditions. There was a plan, about a $2 billion plan, to rebuild it. But yesterday, the county supervisor said no, not good enough. Joining me now to talk about this is Matt Stiles. He covers Los Angeles County for the L.A. Times. Hi.
Hey there. How are you?
Great. Well, just run down the current conditions at this jail.
Yeah, so the jail was built in the early 60s. So it has what you can imagine, the typical sort of damage and repairs that need to be made, just infrastructure, you know, degradation. But it also was designed in more of a prison style. So it has long sort of cavernous hallways without natural light, and it makes it difficult, the jailing officials say, and the county officials say, to create more of a therapeutic environment that can help people with mental illness, even those who are in there for violent felonies that have been suffering from mental illness.
Yeah, because this jail has been called the country's largest mental health facility. There are so many people in there with mental health needs.
That's right. There are multiple jails in LA County. There's the Men's Central Jail, but across the network, there's about 17,000 people, you know, at any given time in jail, and about a third of them have been classified as having mental health needs, and that varies from jail to jail, of course.
Right. So it's just the plan to redo this particular jail, the Men's Central, right?
Right.
And that it was going to cost about $2 billion. Why did the supervisors say no?
Well, they've had this long progression on this issue. In 2015, it was decided that there needed to be some sort of replacement for this aging jail. And they set about hiring consultants and doing studies and making plans and designs, and spent tens of millions of dollars on that. In 2018, they came back with a plan to build what they called a consolidated correctional treatment facility that was sort of leaning in the direction that they think they need to go in terms of mental health. But over time, mental health advocates and others have been concerned that it was too centralized and that it didn't focus enough on treatment. It was focused on custody, on housing, on prison. And so in February, the supervisors, on a divided vote, decided to change focus a little bit and call it the Mental Health Treatment Center. And what they found in the intervening months is that the contract that they had already signed, that they were about to start paying, just didn't have the flexibility to go as far as the supervisors wanted. So rather than trying to make this a new sort of new strategy for jailing in name only, they scrapped the contract entirely and agreed to start again.
So if they're calling it a treatment facility, they're not even calling it a jail anymore?
I think, you know, it's clear, and this is part of the debate, there was one no vote among the supervisors, and this came up. It's clear that there will be some jailing. There will be thousands of people in jail for violent felonies in Los Angeles County, regardless of what they build. But there's an understanding that if they are going to be housing people in jails, that they can do it in a more decentralized way, where people are given more personalized care, depending on what, you know, what their issues are. There will be a focus on diversion out of a centralized jail into smaller facilities, community-based programs for people who are less likely to commit violence in the community. And there will be people in jail, but the goal is to try to find more of a network of facilities that can deal with people who are justice involved, who have mental health or substance abuse problems.
So it's less about the physical plant than it is about creating a different system.
It is. I mean, right, they have an immediate need to replace the Men's Central Jail. That physical plant is failing. And it's very difficult to keep it into compliance with you know, DOJ lawsuits and agreements that have been made between the Sheriff's Department, the county, and DOJ. And so the Sheriff's Department very much wants a replacement more in line with a central jail that is designed to be more therapeutic, but still a large warehouse for a large number of men. And I think the county supervisors want to take one more swipe at studying this. Now, whether at the end of a long period of study, they'll come back and realize that what they found, you know, they've since outgrown that project, we don't know. But there is a need to replace the physical plant.
Hmm. Well, so in the meantime, what's going to happen? Are they going to try to, I don't know, patchwork in some more mental health treatment?
I think they are. They're doing that now. They are. They've created an Office of Diversion Policy, which looks at people who are going into the jail and studies whether they could be diverted to a community program or substance abuse treatment or some other facility or program that might get them out of more of a custody environment. But they can't do that with everyone. There's in the jails, there are 1,000 people charged with homicide alone. You know, we can't put them into community programs. But even if they are housed, the hope is that there would be units that were more accessible for treatment. There would be natural light. There'd be more sort of general areas where it would be easier to keep track of the inmates, things like that.
Hmm. And so all of this means another delay. And this has been going on, as you say, a long time. How much longer will this now drag on before changes are made?
It could be years, even if they had sort of executed this contract and begun with the design and build process. It would have been years before they replaced the Men's Central Jail. We could be looking at now a discussion between this contractor and the county about how actually, literally, they're going to get out of this contract, whether they can somehow renegotiate it with a new design. All that will have to be hashed out after a period in which the chief executive of the county is going to study, you know, what's our strategy going forward. So it could be a few years more before we find out what ultimately will be built and where.
Matt Stiles, he covers LA County for the LA Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, stocks tumble today. Are we headed towards a recession? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The stock market has spent the last 10 years going up and up and up, the longest bull market in U.S. history. Not today, though. It was the worst day of the year on Wall Street. The S&P down nearly 3%, the Dow down more than 800 points. Well, this is not the first market stumble in recent weeks, and it has some economists wondering if we're headed for a recession. Here to talk about what this means is Josh Mitchell. He covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, so what's behind this drop in stocks today?
Well, there was a lot of global economic data that came out overnight that shows the global economy is not doing too well. The German economy, the Chinese economy, both of those seem to be having problems right now. The German economy contracted, for example, and this is all linked to mostly to the trade dispute that's been going on in the U.S. here. And so there's big questions about whether the U.S. economy is going to be impacted by that.
How is the German economy impacted by the U.S.-China trade war?
So the German economy is the biggest economy in Europe. And it's also the number four economy in the world. And the Chinese economy is the number two economy in the world. And so what the concern is that if those two economies increasingly are impacted by this trade dispute, eventually it could hit U.S. firms and then U.S. households. So far, it doesn't look like that's happened. It's definitely dinged the U.S., but it hasn't put a major dent in the U.S. economy. But the concern is that the longer this goes on, eventually it could hurt U.S. consumers and households and the economy at large.
Right. And so the Trump administration was going to impose a whole new set of tariffs, and they've delayed that till the end of the year. And that didn't really do anything to calm investors?
Well, so it did at first. I mean, there was a pickup yesterday in stocks, but then stocks went down when, again, this data that came out of the other global economy started to show that growth is weaker. And, you know, I just think there's a lot of uncertainty right now among investors. That's the big thing. You know, the data itself is not too concerning, but it's kind of like what you don't know. And so investors are just trying to guess. You know, you have to keep in mind we've been in this expansion for 10 years in the U.S., and there's this big question, how long can that go on, and when is the next downturn going to occur? And so there's a lot of guessing going on right now. And I think one of the concerns right now is just the trade dispute. You know, one day the administration says we're going to slap on all these tariffs, the next day they say we're going to put them off. And so right now, there's just really uncertain what the outcome of that dispute is going to be.
And then the Fed cut interest rates a couple of weeks ago, and it did that. Why? Because it was afraid a recession was on the horizon?
Yeah, it's kind of trying to prevent a recession from happening. And, you know, trying to get ahead of the curve here. And, you know, again, but there's this big question mark, again, whether lower interest rates is going to help or how much it will help. Is the problem, you know, that interest rates are too high right now, or is there something bigger going on? And so, you know, that's one of the big question marks is, you know, how much will that actually help the underlying issues with the economy right now?
What about the housing market? Prices are high in many cities, including here in Los Angeles. And of course, high housing prices played a big role in the last recession. What's happening there?
Yeah, so that's a good thing to ask. You know, the housing market, we've seen a big run up in prices, which is what happened in the early 2000s. And so at first blush, you know, you might be concerned, are we going through another housing crisis that we did? I think the answer is no. And the big reason why is that banks have been really pretty tight in terms of who they give credit to. And so a lot of these loans, even though, you know, the home prices have gone up and Americans have taken on more debt to take out a mortgage, the loans are going to people with, you know, who are not a credit risk. And so what we're seeing is home sales are pretty weak, but the people who own the homes and have a mortgage are actually not really having that much trouble paying down their mortgage. So I think the issue right there is that the housing market is not giving a boost to the economy right now, but it also isn't really presenting a systemic risk. Keep in mind what happened in the early 2000s is that a lot of loans went to a lot of homeowners who there was red flags as to whether they'd be able to pay them off. Either they didn't have the incomes to support the high loans that they had, or you know, they didn't have steady jobs. So there was a lot of issues that happened with lending last time that we don't really see this time around.
Yeah, but this time around, we have a lot of foreign investment in the housing market, especially from China. And with China pulling back on that investment in with this trade war and other problems with its own economy, could that then do something very bad to the broader housing market? Could that force a downturn?
Yeah. So I have to caution that, you know, I don't have a crystal ball here, and I'm scared that I'm going to say, oh, don't worry about this, and the next year all of a sudden there's going to be a crash. So, you know, that being said, I think, again, the concern is not necessarily that there's going to be a housing crash. I think you're right. That is a concern. But I think the bigger issue is it's just going to prevent future sales from happening at least as quickly as a lot of homeowners would like. So it just might take longer to sell that house. But again, I think one of the reasons why a lot of economists are not that worried about that is because, you know, a lot of people who own those loans, they're not showing a lot of trouble in paying them off. So, and we have seen in some areas home prices have gone down. So that is a risk. But again, it's not the systemic risk that the last housing market, you know, cave the economy.
But I guess just to the casual observer, it just seems unsustainable when you've got these incredible prices for tiny, tiny little apartments. Who's buying these and how long can that continue?
Well, I think you make a good point. And, you know, people who are buying them are people who have the incomes to buy them. And again, you know, I do think, you know, what we have seen in some cities that home prices have either stalled or in some cases they've gone down. And I think the result of that is, you know, companies and some homeowners are moving to other cities, you know, these secondary cities, whether it's Denver or Austin. And so, you know, it's kind of pushing, you know, the economic growth into other areas. Take San Francisco, for example. You know, on the one hand, it looks like it's unsustainable. You're right. I mean, look at how high prices have gone, but look at how much wealth is in tech right now. And so if you look at a city like San Francisco, a lot of that is, you know, these employees for these tech firms who are getting wealthy just off of that stock. And so they're buying houses or, as you say, foreign investors. So I think that there's a big issue there in terms of, you know, whether the middle class or even people, you know, in the lower middle class, their ability to pay. And so, but that's more of a concern of, like, you know, the opportunity for those people to get wealthy, mm-hmm. as opposed to whether it's going to cause a market crash.
Josh Mitchell covers the economy for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Josh.
Sure. Thank you.
Well, sometimes more money means more problems for the newly rich, including on the dating scene. Enter elite matchmaker Amy Anderson, known as the Cupid of Silicon Valley. Her company is called Lynx Dating, and she matches high net worth individuals, including wealthy tech execs and entrepreneurs and the occasional royal or celebrity. I spoke with Amy Anderson earlier. So who uses your site? How rich do they have to be?
So I do have a website, but my business is actually offline. It's very old world that way. So it's referral based, and I'm working with a very specific demographic of highly educated professionals who are extremely goal oriented towards the direction of finding monogamy and marriage.
Wow. That sounds like a project. Goal oriented.
They are very results oriented and very focused on that one mission to find, in many cases, a needle in a haystack match. But they also have major time constraints when it comes to the actual bandwidth of being able to dedicate to a project like this. So they like the idea of outsourcing their love life to the hands of a professional matchmaker like myself.
Okay, you've used terms that don't sound very romantic. Bandwidth, project, outsourcing. I mean, it doesn't sound like the language of love, to be honest.
Well, in some regards, it is a bit of a business deal. You know, they come into my office with very specific requirements. It's kind of like this, you know, for some of my clients, my VIPs, it's a long dossier of requirements of what they're looking for.
Then let's say you think, okay, I think this person and this person would go well together. Mm-hmm. Then you arrange a date, and then mm-hmm. and then do you coach them about how they should perform, how they should act?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, and yes. So basically, I would present both respective parties' baby bios, and these are original renditions of who I'm thinking about for each client. And it's about, I'd say, a paragraph or two that individual has taken substantial time to write about themselves. So I'd be presenting that little baby bio, and I give my clients a lot of autonomy to digest that information and really think through if it makes sense to take it forward or not. If both parties want to take it forward, then that's when a match is official and the gentleman gets the female's phone number. He knows to call her within 5 days. So I do have some rules and some guidelines. Call her within 5 days and then treat her to a nice dinner out.
So does it work in the reverse? Do you give the woman the man's number and ask her to call him?
No.
Within? No?
No.
Even if she's the client?
No, because that woman, even if she is at the top of her game in her career, I have learned from these women, even the most high-powered women in the world, that they do want somebody to be chivalrous and they do want to be treated like a lady. So she doesn't want to have to necessarily kind of be the so-called man and do the pursuing.
Really?
Most women.
Did that surprise you?
No. Not at all, because especially seeing just this, what I would consider epidemic happening with online dating and the dating apps, where people, they really are looking for some more traditional values in the context of dating.
What if it's same sex, or do you not have same sex clients?
I wish I did. I just don't have the expertise or frankly the network to do that.
And how much do you charge?
So it's very wide ranging. Everything is completely customized. There's actually two tiers. Either you're passive in the database where there's no fees and you would pay based on success. If you're reaching successful milestones, such as you become exclusive, you get engaged, you get married from my match, then you would compensate based on those different milestones. Or you get a guarantee of introductions. You work really closely with me and you become my next premium client, to which a basic membership would give you 8 introductions. That's $35,000. For some of my clients, they are looking for somebody so specific that I realize what they're looking for, I simply do not have in my database, that I have to recruit. And that is somebody who would become my next VIP client. Those memberships start at $150,000.
A year?
It's 24 months. It's 24 months, and it's amortized over that two-year time horizon. And those individuals often are paying substantial bonuses, too, because they are so focused on finding somebody that they want to reward me at the very end of it if I find them their future husband or future wife.
Can you give me an example of when that's happened?
Absolutely.
I mean, not naming names, but just every identifying detail aside from the name, obviously.
Sure. So one very well-known Silicon Valley tech entrepreneur started working with me in December of last year, very high-profile individual, and he came into my office and did a little trial kind of VIP membership just that gave him a couple of introductions guaranteed. But this is very high stakes. You know, he's paying $50,000 or so per introduction. But wanted somebody extremely specific, intellectually, the exact physical match, blonde hair, blue eyes, a very kind of curvy physique, and somebody who was a Stanford grad. But we actually ended up finding the candidate in our database of static members, and we reached out to her, not knowing her eligibility status at all, nor aware if she would even be interested in this particular client of ours. And brought her into the office very quickly and realized that there was really a unique match here, and they connected on so many levels when it came to their hobbies of playing chess and backgammon and their passion for travel and particular authors even, and really, really connecting based on those foundational interests and personality too. He's an alpha. He's looking for somebody who's going to definitely keep up with him intellectually, somebody who's looking for 4+ kids. And that's not all women at all. So we realized that we had really kind of isolated this needle in a haystack match for him. They were exclusive in the first month or so. And I just had a meeting with him last Friday, and he was asking me when he should propose, how he should go about doing it. And he didn't know that traditionally when a man does that, you know, he can get down on his knee and present the ring and ask for her hand in marriage. He thought maybe he would get down on his knee, ask for her hand, and then weeks later give the ring. And I said, well, you know, it's better maybe kind of do it all in one fell swoop. And it goes to show that this process really works.
Well, it is surprising that people who are so rich and so successful in so many ways kind of don't know the basics of romance and need your help doing that. I mean, the fact that he didn't know that you should have a ring if you're going to propose, it seems a little...
It's
kind of surprising.
It's innocent.
Do you match people in Silicon Valley with people here in LA?
I do. Actually, I'm seeing a really significant growing trend of Silicon Valley types looking for Los Angeles-based matches. And similarly, a lot of women in LA pinging me looking for Silicon Valley-based men.
And I guess they're looking for something a little different if they're looking outside of their normal area.
For sure. People in Silicon Valley, there is so much cross-pollinization here. So the concept of dating in a different pond is really nice and refreshing. And the women in LA, I find that, you know, especially high net worth women, they are looking for somebody who is really going to be that dynamic force in their life. And they love the idea of actually finding somebody to have a monogamous, loving relationship with is very exciting.
Wow. Sounds like you have a thriving business.
I'm very blessed.
Amy Anderson, she's an elite matchmaker. The company is called Lynx Dating in Silicon Valley. Amy, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me be here.
Coming up, 1 million black farmers lost their land in the Deep South, and it was not an accident.
You know, when you're investing in the Mississippi Delta, you're investing in a place where the soil is watered with blood. And I don't know if it's possible to disentangle that investment from that history.
We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Mississippi Delta, home to the blues, also home to rich, fertile soil, excellent for growing crops. It is in the Deep South, and of course, the land was made productive for agriculture by slaves who eventually, after emancipation, came to own some of that land. Well, now, most of that farmland is owned, again, by white people. By corporations, mainly. A new Atlantic article explores what happened and how black people were systematically cheated out of their own land. Van Newkirk wrote that article, and he joins me now. Hi.
How you doing?
I'm great, thanks. Well, you argue that, you know, during the New Deal back in the 30s and during the Depression, there were a lot of programs put forward by the federal government to help farmers, mainly white farmers, I suppose. And you say, though, that federal policy actually hindered black people from becoming landowners and farmers. How did that work?
Yeah, these programs in the 1930s, the federal government needed to save a lot of poor farmers. A lot of farmers are losing their land. Agriculture in this country just could not work at scale without major federal investment. But what happened was these programs did save some farmers, but they also promoted the conglomeration of farms. They promoted farms getting larger and larger, which moved lots of small farmers, white and black and Latino as well, off their land. But what happened to black folks was actually pretty particular to them and the result of discrimination. So what this injection of money also did was it empowered in places in the Deep South. The people who gave the money out, they were locally elected in places where only white people could vote. So it gave them even more power over the local structures than they had before. And one thing they did not want black folks to do was vote. They didn't want you to join the NAACP. They did not want you challenging segregation. In a time when most black folks were farmers, now they had a really good, nonviolent way of keeping you from doing any of that. They could and did often. If you joined the NAACP, if you looked like you were causing trouble, they took your farm money away and took your land.
So how would that work? A black farmer mm-hmm. would say, okay, I need a loan to buy some farm equipment, for example. And the bank would say, no, I see that you have been active in voting rights protests, or you've voted, I guess, mm-hmm. or anything
yeah.
that
That's
any
it.
Citizen should be allowed to do. And they would say, no, we're going to deny your loan?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Well, the banks themselves were discriminatory at baseline. Lots of them just did not deal with black clients. And that meant the black clients would have to go through either the big white plantation owners themselves for credit or have to go to the federal government. And often the federal government, the local committees were run by those plantation owners themselves too. So it really was like, yeah, I need a little bit of money. I should probably keep my mouth shut. Or when people did go out there and march, somebody saw your face, somebody sees your name, and they send it into the local agricultural committee. And now we know you are not getting your federal money.
And that translated into a loss of billions of dollars.
Billions. In Mississippi alone, we've had some great researchers led by Derek Hamilton calculate that in 14 years, from 1950 to 1964, somewhere north between $4.7 and around $7 billion of land was stolen from black people. You think about that, just 14 years in just one state.
When you say stolen, can you be more specific?
Yeah.
What do you mean by stolen? I mean, it's one thing to deny a loan based on racial discrimination, but it's another thing to outright steal the land.
So I'm not talking about people running, you know, it did happen in some cases, and it wasn't uncommon where people just got straight up run off the land by people with guns, by Klansmen. But what I'm talking about is a knowing system where people were discriminated against and denied things they were entitled to, that they paid taxes for. And after they were denied those things, and also they were levied fraudulently high tax assessments by federal tax assessors. So what happens after that is they ended up losing the land. And the people who would then administer the partition sales, the auction sales on foreclosures were the folks they owed the money to. And those were the people who were giving the money out in the first place. So I don't know if you can look at it fairly. Look at the fact that 800,000 acres of land were lost in this region by black folks and 800,000 acres were gained by white farmers in the same period. And look at it and say that it was really anything but theft.
Yeah. Sounds like theft. Now, however, it's the big corporations who have moved in, and a lot of family farms, white included, have gone belly up to these large corporations. One of which I was really surprised to learn is my retirement fund, TIAA, which was set up for teachers, right? And
yes,
nonprofits.
And they have a really pretty sterling reputation for being an ethical investor. They were one of the first signatories for the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment in Farmland. And from all the people I've talked to, you know, they really trust TIA to be that type of investor. But, you know, when you're investing in the Mississippi Delta, you're investing in a place where the soil is watered with blood. And I don't know if it's possible to disentangle that investment from that history. The point I make in the piece is not that TIAA and other investors, major investors, got the land they got there by some unethical means, that they were stealing it themselves. But the reason why a lot of this land has become packaged and is even on the market, it comes from these original thefts.
So now what? Now that this land has been amassed by these big corporations and this TIAA retirement fund, what can be done to try to make amends to all of these African-American landowners who lost their land, whose land was stolen from them, as you say? What can be done?
You know, I'm trying to wrap my mind around that right now. Obviously, diagnosis is easier than finding a prescription, right? What I try to do was a work of diagnosis. But there are a couple pieces of this that I think are relatively easy to think about right now. You look at these pension funds, these major investors. I guarantee there's going to be some racial disparities in who has access to those funds. If we're talking about these big funds across the U.S. and outside the U.S. now investing in a place where people live, perhaps those folks should be have access to those pension funds, should have contributions from the funds themselves. Maybe there's some way they can work that out. I'm not sure, but it seems like that's one way we can start. Also, I just think the you mentioned that this corporatization, this Wall Street injection of money is occurring not just in farming, not just with black folks, but across the country in real estate and when it comes to low-income folks of all races. There are lots of people talking about creating things like community land trusts, thinking about ways to preserve the existing housing market that hasn't been corporatized, keeping it affordable, and challenging those major investors in to divest in some cases or to create sections of their portfolios that are accessible to these low-income populations.
So kind of like reparations, in a way.
Kind of like reparations.
Although not in, in cash, but in kind.
Well, yeah, and that's the other part of it, right? It is, this is all part of the larger reparations debate. Now, I was talking mostly about how perhaps local governments and the corporate the corporations themselves could be involved. But obviously, the impetus for a lot of this is the conversation about the federal government's role in reparations. And I haven't seen a whole lot of major solutions that involve land grants. And that was obviously the original form of reparations was 40 acres and a mule. That was a land grant. And that idea persisted for the subsequent decades after the Civil War. W.E.B. Du Bois laments it as probably the biggest missed opportunity of Reconstruction was the fact that black folks did not get land. I don't think we should gloss over that. I think if it was going to be the federal government's position, if the federal government has been involved in giving out major land grants, and that's how, you know, from the Homestead Acts to the GI Bill, how most white families actually end up getting their homes is through some sort of land grant or land subsidy. Why are we not offering that to black folks exclusively, or to people of color exclusively, or to Native Americans who were denied things? We need to have this conversation about what we were willing to provide for creating the white middle class in the suburbs. We had this moment of ambition in America, and we have not displayed similar ambition for people of color and folks on the margins.
Well, I want to thank you so much for a thought-provoking conversation. Appreciate that.
Well, thank you for having me.
Van Newkirk, he's a staff writer at The Atlantic. You can read his article there. It's called The Great Land Robbery, The Shameful Story of How 1 Million Black Families Have Been Ripped from Their Farms. Coming up, why one wine producer hopes to turn Los Angeles into the next Napa Valley. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, before Sonoma, before Napa and Santa Barbara counties became the top destinations for California wine, there was Los Angeles County. Yeah, LA. It had the land, it had the fertile soil, it had the climate to be the state's main wine producer way back in the 19th century. Well, then came Prohibition and disease with a population boom, and that pretty much wiped LA off the wine map. But a new downtown winery is trying to revive LA's winemaking roots. It's called Angelina Wine Company, and all the wines come from grapes grown right here in LA County. Jasper Dixon and Amy Luftig-Visti co-own Angelina Wine, and they join me now. Hi.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having us.
Jasper, this is the first winery in LA in some time. There is another winery in the state. It's called San Antonio Winery. And that's really old, right? More than 100 years old.
Yeah, they started in 1917, just before Prohibition, and ended up making a deal with the Catholic Church so that they could sell sacramental wine and stay in business through Prohibition. And they are really the city's kind of last historical connection to back in the golden era, if you will, of Los Angeles winemaking.
Okay, so cut to now, like more than 100 years later, and here you are trying to make a go of it. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, both me and Amy live here in LA, and this is our home, and this is where we love, and we wanted to make wine and make it here in Los Angeles. And there was no other real kind of infrastructure or anything else going on, and so we said, well, if we're going to do this here, we're just going to have to make our own winery.
Okay, and grow your own grapes, Amy?
Yeah, so we don't grow our own grapes. We work with a really fantastic grower and person named Juan Alonso. And his vineyard, it's called the Alonso Family Vineyard. And it's located about 45 minutes north of downtown in a little town called Agua Dulce. And he came here from Galicia, Spain, I believe in the 70s, and planted all of these really cool Spanish cuttings, Albariño and Grenache and Tempranillo and Gadeo and Ludero and all these lesser known and better known Spanish varieties. And we really pick pretty much the entirety of his vineyard for our wines.
So basically they're all Spanish varietals?
Almost all. He has some that are not, that we also pick, Syrah, Cab Merlot, but by and large, the majority of his vineyard are Spanish varietals.
How did you two learn how to do this? If this is all done, you know, by you guys, it's a small company. How did you learn how to make wine?
Yeah, I learned about winemaking from experimenting around in my garage a lot. And we started off making the wine at a friend's winery up north. And that was a really good foundation to learn from him how to do many different things.
You learned in your garage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, home winemaking.
Sometimes in my garage.
Sometimes in Amy's garage,
that's
too.
That's called hooch, right? I mean.
Yeah. Hey, if you got a garage, I'll make hooch.
If you have a prison, you make hooch.
And Amy, what about you?
I actually started just taking classes about wine and learning about wine and drinking wine. And as I took classes, I became more and more interested in the winemaking process. So ended up going to school at Washington State University for winemaking and paired up with Jesper, and am still learning to this day.
And why did you choose to locate in downtown, about a mile away from the San Antonio Winery? Are you trying to compete with them?
No, they make maybe about, I don't know, like maybe 500,000 cases a year. We make about 2,000 cases a year, so
hopefully we're not competing.
Yeah, hopefully we're not competing with them. But no, we were looking all around LA. It actually took us almost 3 years to find a home. There's kind of all these old zoning laws in LA that's really prohibitionary and very restrictive against wineries that can only be in this highest level industrial zone. And so that, combined with the fact that we had no money, combined with the fact that we needed a small space because that was all we could afford as well, it really narrowed it down and only gave us a few areas that we could really play with. We had looked in that area, in this area called Mission Junction, just north of Chinatown, for some time. And we had heard friends of ours that have a company called Cider 101 were going to move there, and we just fell in love with it.
It also ended up being pretty perfect because after we signed the lease, we started really digging into the history of the area. And as you mentioned, Los Angeles used to be a city of vines and winemakers. There used to be over 200 winemakers making about 2 million bottles of wine a year. And many of them were centered around where our winery is now. And in fact, the three streets that surround our winery were on Spring Street, but the three other streets that surround us are named after those old winemakers. They're the last names of those French winemakers that were here. So it ended up being pretty perfect that we're really right in the middle of where that winemaking community used to be.
So what has held people back from doing what you're doing until now? Why has there only been the San Antonio Winery and now you and no one else?
Well, I think a lot of it is that when a lot of people down here and a lot of people that I know that live in L.A. and actually do make wine outside of L.A., like up in Santa Barbara, for example, or further up in the Central Coast, they love the kind of bucolic idea of that. And I think people naturally want to go up, you know, even if they're located here, go up and make wine and be up there. But we wanted to be in the city. We wanted to be where the people are and where we love. And I think it stops a lot of people too, because there's not much there is none really infrastructure here for wineries. You know, if you go all up and down the West Coast in San Diego, in you know, even smaller towns like San Luis Obispo and in San Francisco and Portland and Seattle, there's urban wineries all over the place. And there's a lot of places where people can get, you know, whether it's like lab testing for your wine or if you need to buy a barrel or this or that, there's infrastructure for it. And down here, there's just nothing. And I think that combined with the kind of very archaic zoning laws and various things have just kind of held people back.
And any move to change those zoning laws?
Yeah, so we tried. We spoke with city council, we spoke with the zoning administrators, we spoke with planning. I think that's the goal. And, you know, we would really love to see a community of winemakers in LA. You know, Angelino Wine Company is a tasting room, it's a winery, but it's also an opportunity for people to come and learn about the history of LA winemaking. We would like to see 200 more of us in the city.
Really? Because you also want to make some money.
Yeah. Well, we like to make some money anyway. But, you know, I think that it's, you know, I think a rising tide lifts all boats, right? When people come to wine country, they like to go to 2, 3, 4, 5 wineries.
Yeah.
And, you know, winemaking is, I think, very unusual in that winemakers tend to be very community driven. They tend to be very helpful instead of competitive. And we'd love to have more friends and family in the industry and in the area.
And where can people drink your wine aside from the tasting room?
Yes, we're currently distributed just statewide here in California, and yeah, a great wine stores to go to get the wines would be Silver Lake Wine or Everson Royce in Pasadena, the wine house over in West LA is Carrot Wines, Venice Beach Wines, great little wine shop on Rose and restaurant has always had our wines. Jelena also has been a big supporter. There's a few places around town. We've been very fortunate with that.
It's really fun to come to the winery, though, because when you come to the winery, you can see where the wine is made. We have a little tour that we do. The space is only 1,500 square feet, so the tour is very short. But it's really great to be able to have people try the wines and see where they're made and kind of walk through how the production happens. We do everything by hand at the winery. We pick the fruit ourselves. We process the fruit. We barrel age it and even bottle it all by hand. So it's really as local as it gets, and it's an awesome opportunity for people to come and see how wine is made, maybe even become part of the winemaking process if they stop by in the fall and see that LA wines can be good.
Well, thank you both so much. And cheers.
No, thank you for having us.
Jasper Dixon, Amy Luftig-Visti, co-own Angelina Wine. And that's now open in downtown Los Angeles. Okay, we're going to do a little something different.
A little bit different today.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm good. What have you done with Michelle?
I made her an offer she couldn't refuse. I offered to do feedback, and that joke will make a lot of sense in just a minute.
Okay, well, let's get to it, because you have come here because you have a particular obsession.
I have been obsessed with this story of Chris Cuomo for the past week. So the CNN anchor got into a heated argument over the weekend with a group of men, and it was caught on video, and let's just hear some of it.
From the right, call me Fredo. My name is Chris Cuomo. I'm an anchor on CNN.
Oh, you're much...
Fredo is from The Godfather. He was that weak brother.
Isn't that your
and
brother?
And they use it as an Italian aspersion. Any of you Italian?
I'm a little
Are you
bit.
Italian?
It's an
insult to your people. It's an insult to your people. It's like the N-word for us.
Really?
No, of course not. I
had never heard that before.
Fredo as an insult.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I mean, I'm not Italian-American,
It's a reference to The Godfather, the middle brother, the middle Corleone brother, but it's pretty low on the insult range when it comes to Italian-Americans, unless you have ties to the mafia, which, of course, very few people of Italian descent do. It was posted online to a conservative blogosphere, went viral. CNN defended Cuomo, what they described as an ethnic slur, and Cuomo later tweeted, "I appreciate the support, but the truth is I should be better than the people baiting me. It happens all the time. I should be better than what I oppose and not add to the ugliness."
But I could see how this idea that because he's Italian-American, he's associated with the mafia, that is a slur.
Sure. And also, given his background in his biography, Chris Cuomo, he's the son of a former New York governor, Mario Cuomo. He's the brother of a current New York governor, Andrew Cuomo. So in a way, He didn't go into the family business just like Fredo Corleone and The Godfather. Also, in a 2010 radio interview, Chris Cuomo referred to himself as Fredo in reference to his father and brother. So, come on.
He referred to himself as Fredo?
He referred to himself as Fredo, yeah. So, how can you be upset about what's happened here when you've done it yourself?
Well, actually, I kind of liked Fredo.
Fredo was great and, you know, portrayed by a wonderful actor, John Cazale. Village Voice once called him the finest actor in America. He made five films throughout the course of the 1970s. All of them were nominated for Best Picture. And he died of lung cancer in 1978. Who knows what kind of career he could have had.
Oh, that's sad.
It is sad.
Yeah. Okay, so Brian, thank you for bringing us out, your obsession.
My pleasure.
Guess what? Fredo's here.
Brian did make me an offer I couldn't refuse. But then I got some great feedback, and then
play.
I couldn't refuse.
Hello,
that
Michelle.
Feedback.
Okay, so quickly, what do you have?
Kristen Lopez says, I have been listening to Press Play since it started. I have never hated a story before. The story about the matchmaker for millionaires was like driving nails into my eardrum. I could not relate any less. We're sorry to have driven nails into your eardrums.
Yeah, we got a lot of comments
all part
on
of
that
the
matchmaker piece.
Fredo,
you're,
so
you are not Fredo, actually. I think you're more the Sonny of Press Play.
It's
all
true.
Right. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll be off for the next couple of days, and I'll see you next week.